From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Scared Monkeys Radio. Of course, my name is Dana Pretzer. Tonight, for the whole show, we're going to talk about Jodi Arias. Have you been following the trial? I'm sure you have. If you listen to this program, you'll be watching that trial and wondering, what's this gal all about? My first guest tonight is a criminologist, media expert. You can find him at Twitter at Doc Bonn, D-O-C-B-O-N-N. Dr. Scott Bonn, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nice to have you. We talked a little bit off air. Comparing this case to Casey Anthony, we'll get into that in a couple of minutes. This is the first time that you've been on my program, and I appreciate that. Tell the folks a little bit about yourself.
I'd be happy to. I am a criminologist and a professor at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey, which is about 25 miles outside of Manhattan, due west. And I study do research on particularly homicide, exotic types of homicide, and of which the Jodi Arias case is certainly one. And I'm currently doing some research and writing a book about serial killers, but not from the perspective so much of why they do it. We know a lot about that. It's really more about the public's fascination with serial killers. Why are we drawn to these ghoulish individuals? And the working title of it so far is Monster Dearest, Our Macabre Fascination with Serial Killers.
You know, and you make such a good point, whether it's a serial killer or a someone who was accused of something. I've said it many times on the program. When I had Drew Peterson on the program, before he was charged yet suspected, probably one of the biggest ratings I've ever had on the show, yet the most hate mail, and the public is certainly fascinated. Let's talk about this. Looking at your website and some stories that you've written, you can find the find doctor's website at docbonn.com, D-O-C-B-O-N-N.com. We talk about Casey Anthony, another story that we've all covered. The media covered it, and the comparisons to the Jodi Arias trial, there's a lot there. Let's talk about them a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, first and foremost, they're what we call top of the wedding cake cases in criminal justice, meaning that they receive all of the attention of the criminal justice system as well as the media. So they occupy that, you know, little tiny tier at the top of the wedding cake of criminal justice, to use that analogy. And you have, first and foremost, two just absolutely gorgeous young women. Yep. Who are charged in the case of Jodi Anthony, the trial ongoing, with crimes that are just seemingly incomprehensible and actually incongruous to their physical appearance. It's just hard to imagine, and I think that drives the public fascination, how someone like this, who looks like this, could be responsible potentially for stabbing their ex-boyfriend 27 times, shooting him in the head, and slicing him ear to ear for good measure.
Yeah, in self-defense, according to the defense. Well, we'll get to
right, exactly.
We'll get to that in a few minutes.
Which, by the way, I don't think is going to fly. And it is story number three, by the way. You know, her first story upon capture was that she wasn't there at all.
Right.
And then when they found the bloody palm print and the camera in the washing machine with photographs of them having sex a few minutes before she likely killed him, she said, well, yes, I was there, but masked intruders came in and killed him while I was screaming and hiding in the corner. And now story number three is, yes, I did it, but I did it in self-defense, and I'm a battered woman.
Yeah, there we go. And as something that I'm sure the Lifetime people are sitting back writing the script for the movie right now. They've done Peterson, they've done Anthony. Arias will be the next one. Let's talk about the media part. You're a media guy. Mugging to the camera, the 48 hours interview, which may come back to haunt her. Of course, Anthony was coverage nonstop. Nancy Grace and the other crime shows on television, that was their bread and butter for quite some time. What about the media and how they're covering this trial?
Yeah, well, very, very similar. And I, again, the part of the fascination and also part of the appeal, frankly, is that these are gorgeous young women. If these were unattractive individuals charged with these crimes, and if they were perhaps people of color, for example, I doubt that there would be nearly as much attention. It's the fact that these are really drop-dead gorgeous young white women, and that's one of the reasons, primary reasons, we're getting so much coverage. And also another commonality with the Casey Anthony story is the fact that I think we're dealing with two real card-carrying sociopaths here. Yeah. And Judy Arias, it's her unabashed ability to just change stories and then each one as if it's the gospel truth. And when one doesn't work, well, let's just change the story to fit the new evidence. It's just incredible, and it's the hallmark of a narcissistic sociopath to believe her own reality.
The media wants to grab the story. They want to run with the story. Of course, they're looking for ratings, and you're right. The pretty girl, the story of the Anthonys, or poor little Kaylee, this case, the Arias. But what about the coverage itself, the talking heads, so to speak, the lawyers that come on and make the predictions on this show? I don't know how many Anthony stories that we did here. I had one lawyer, Wendy Murphy, who came on this program and said that Casey Anthony will get off. And boy, did she get a lot of hate mail about that. But she was right. Where the rest of them, the Monday morning quarterbacks, they were all wrong. What about that? And how do you handle that from the media perspective and the lawyer perspective?
That's a great question. And of course, when there's so much attention given to a story like this or a case like this, there's always the likelihood and possibility of the jury being influenced by the publicity. And in the case of Casey Anthony, it's a slightly different situation. That was largely a circumstantial case.
Yep.
And they were asking for capital punishment, first-degree murder. And I really believe that the prosecutors just set the bar too high. And so I had a much less degree of confidence of conviction there than I do here. I really believe that the evidence is so strong in this case that despite all of the publicity, despite the hoopla, despite the three-ring circus that the media has created and the likelihood that the jury will be influenced, I have a much higher degree of confidence that they're going to come back with a verdict of guilty this time.
Speaking of hoopla and the three-ring circus, I understand that some of Jody Arias' art is selling on eBay. Let's talk about that.
Absolutely. It's been reported that she's already made something in the neighborhood of $1,100 by selling a number of her jailhouse sketches on eBay through a third party. And I actually have seen pictures of some of her art on the internet, and she's a pretty decent artist.
Oh,
she's
really?
Pretty, okay. Pretty talented. Well, she's a photographer as well. And, this is also very similar to the fact that people collect art and artifacts from serial killers as well. This collector obsession with killers is not at all new. And the thing is, right now, because she hasn't been convicted of anything, she's able to do this. And apparently, the reports are that she's using this money for a couple of things. One, to use as a travel fund for her family. And then also, apparently Jody doesn't like the food she's getting in prison, so she wants to buy some new snacks, some new jailhouse snacks for her while she's there. And as you know, however, if she is convicted, then the Son of Sam law will go into effect, and she will not be able to benefit from the sale of any of this stuff, which was specifically as a result of David Berkowitz's conviction and all of the hoopla that surrounded his story afterwards.
Criminologist and media expert Dr. Scott Bond is here. Let's talk about the prosecution. My second guest this evening is going to say the prosecution has missed a bunch. It's first degree with aggravating circumstances. That's a pretty tough nut to prove, is it not?
It absolutely is. And but in this case, I think it really applies. I mean, there's ample evidence that she had planned this in advance, had packed a gun, had driven 24 hours to see Travis, and certainly the act itself is demonstrative of overkill and aggravating circumstances. I mean, just the whole concept that 27 stab wounds, shooting someone in the head and then slitting their throat ear to ear is self-defense. In and of itself, that's just illogical.
When we use the term sociopath or someone with a narcissistic personality, and the folks, Joe and Mary Sixpack, that are out there listening in the listening audience are saying, what in hell is they, what are they talking about, these $25 words? What is a sociopath?
Thank you very much for asking. I think it's really important to clarify this, and whenever I have this opportunity to talk about it, I like to take the time to do this. There's two terms that you hear so much in the crime news. You hear about psychopaths and you hear about sociopaths.
Yep.
And sometimes they're used interchangeably, and even professionals like myself sometimes use them interchangeably. But I believe, and many others do as well, that they're two very, very different things. The way I like to use an analogy of a machine with an electrical cord plugged in the wall. And that electrical cord, imagine if that's the thing that allows for empathy. It's the connection that allows two human beings to connect and emotionally bond with one another. In the case of a psychopath, that plug is just completely pulled out of the wall. They have no ability whatsoever to connect. They're cold-blooded, and they can kill with no remorse at all. In the case of a sociopath, it's almost like that cord has a faulty connection. Sometimes they're completely out of touch and cold and remorse. Other times they can be highly emotional and even volatile. And I believe that the actions of Jody Arias and Casey Anthony, for that matter, are very demonstrative of a sociopath, because Jody can be calm and detached and demure and seemingly unaffected by all of this at one moment, but then the murder itself demonstrates tremendous rage to shoot and stab and slice someone's throat that way. Yeah. And there are ample evidence that she was highly jealous and highly volatile. So that's very consistent with a sociopathic personality. So sociopaths can bond with people, some people in certain circumstances, but to the rest of the world, they're largely detached and unaffected. And it's not a mental illness, by the way. It's an antisocial personality disorder, which is why these individuals rarely are able to use an insanity defense. They're not insane. Clinically, they have a powerful personality disorder, but it's not insanity like schizophrenia or something, where someone is completely in their own little world.
What about those that say and use the term crime of passion? And historically, crimes of passion, you will see multiple stab wounds, several gunshots, because someone is so angry. Does that fit into premeditation, or is that somebody that just got angry? Did they plan it, or did they just lose it?
Well, a crime of passion is a broad term. This was a crime of passion, but I believe that it was a premeditated crime of passion. A crime of passion can mean specifically where someone snaps, where there was no premeditation at all. Imagine, for example, coming home from work. Someone comes home from work and finds their significant other in bed with someone else.
Right.
Now, in that circumstance, they might lose it momentarily and pick up a lamp and smash both people over the head and kill them. That's not premeditated.
No.
It is a crime of passion in a very, very specific sense. That would not, in all likelihood, qualify for first-degree murder. The reason that this one does is because there's so much evidence that Jody planned this out in advance, that she packed the gun. She knew exactly what she was doing. She bought bullets. She was prepared. And she colored her hair and all of these different pieces of evidence that suggest she knew exactly what she was going to do. But in a broader sense, it is a crime of passion because it was driven by her jealousy and rage.
Mainstream media versus social media. When it comes to covering stories like this, my website, this website that I work with, the blog that we work with, we're not mainstream media. I like to use the term main street media. It's the folks like to be able to come and say what they think and not hear, 50 or 60 second sound bites. What about that? How about social media versus mainstream media when it comes to cases like this and Casey Anthony?
Well, the social media are a powerful tool in modern society of instant communication, and they can be wonderful in terms of access and think about solving crimes in cases of missing children and abductions, those sort of things. Social media can be wonderful tools of discovery and to help society, but at the same time, they also can promote the rumor mill. And so frequently we have misinformation that is distributed through the social media. So it really cuts both ways. It's technology in and of itself is a wonderful thing to the extent that it can help mankind. It's how it's used. And if it's used recklessly and to promote rumors, then it has the power or the potential of being very damaging.
Criminologist and media expert Dr. Scott Bonds here. I always ask this question to folks like you, prosecutors, defense attorneys, the people. What about cameras in the courtroom? You and I love it because we can see what's going on, but is, some of the Casey Anthony going back to OJ, everybody was playing to the camera. What about cameras in the courtroom in general?
If from the standpoint of the justice system and the outcome of the cases, I think it's neutral. I don't think it really influences the cases themselves. What it does do is has the potential of dividing society, certainly as the O.J. Simpson case did when it became highly racialized, and it really did divide society along those lines. The Casey Anthony case, of course, she became public enemy number one in the minds of the population as that trial went on because she was so demonized. So it has the potential to promote negative feelings and prejudice and stereotype. So to that extent, it can have a negative influence, but in terms of the justice system itself, I don't really believe that it has an impact on the trials, so I think it's fine from that regard.
From the legal aspect, Drew Peterson's lawyer Joel Brodsky told me many times on this program that he encourages the media coverage. He's going to do everything he can in the media to promote his case, so to speak, and that backfired on him. What about the lawyers and media coverage?
Well, there's a great question. So many times we have these weeks, particularly before trials begin, pretrial publicity, and the lawyers themselves are almost always the sources of those leaks, even though they can be disbarred for doing so. So it's a practice, it's something that happens in the criminal justice system. So, which is, of course, why we have one of our constitutional amendments is for a speedy trial to try to not allow pretrial publicity to have that kind of an effect. But lawyers, yes, lawyers engage in it. They will use the media to their advantage if they can.
Last question, and I do really appreciate you coming on, Dr. Scott Bond. When you look at this case, and we all talk about the death penalty, and it's a pretty open question, and you and I could probably do a whole half-hour segment on the death penalty, is the Jodi Arias case a death penalty case?
I believe that it is, and regardless of how you stand on death penalty in general, whether you're opposed or against, if we just accept for the fact that this is the law, then this case certainly qualifies. Of cases in recent memory, particularly high-profile cases, this meets the standard. It is there's ample evidence that she did this murder, that it was done in premeditated fashion, and it has the aggravating circumstances, the overkill aspect of it that makes it particularly heinous. So I would say that, yes, it qualifies as a death penalty case.
What we'll do, and hopefully you'll come back on the program sometime, is tomorrow, next week, next day, there will be another high-profile case, and I fib to you, I'm going to ask you one last quick question. Whatever that case may be, whether it's a murder case or a missing persons case or a whatever case, what can the media do to do a better job when it comes to covering these cases, or is the media doing a pretty good job?
The short answer to your two question is to be honest and to be objective, because I think all too often the thought is about ratings and being sensationalized. We live in a 24/7 era of news on demand, and let's face it, sensationalism and hyperbole sells, and who screams the loudest, who's the most outrageous, that tends to be the one who gets attention. So facts and integrity tend to go out the window in such a situation. So I would say be honest, have integrity, and speak the truth, and let the chips fall as they may, because the feeding frenzy, much like the paparazzi, can lead to disaster.
Like the late Jack Webb used to say, just the facts. Criminologist, media expert, Dr. Scott Bond. You can find him on Twitter at Doc Bond. His website, www.docbond.com. Thank you, sir. I really enjoyed our time.
I enjoyed it as well, and having me on.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's media expert Dr. Scott Bond. He's been everywhere. He's been NBC and MTV, and he knows what he's talking about when it comes to this. He's a criminologist, media expert. He's in Manhattan, and we all know where that is. We're going to take a break here on the Dana Pretzer Show and come back with our sister blogger, Blink, with more Jodi Arias coverage. Hey, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. I don't know why I always play a binge drinking PSA just before I bring Blink on. No, I'm not sorry.
No, seriously?
No, I didn't. I didn't mean that. It wasn't. It was a missing persons PSA, and I apologize. Our sister blogger Blink from Blink on Crime is here to continue our discussion on the Jodi Arias trial. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, Dana. How are you?
I am fine. I'm not sure if you got to hear the good doctor talking about...
I did. I enjoyed Dr. Bond very much.
Talking about this, and we're going to get into more Jodi Arias discussion with you. Of course, the folks can go to blinkoncrime.com to read your analysis of the case. This is quite the case. How comparable is it to the Casey Anthony trial?
Well, I think it's very comparable in a variety of ways, and I think Dr. Bond did a good job of kind of paralleling these two ladies. But one thing I'd like to point out is the media aspect is just really now kicking in for the Arias case, whereas it started that way and in the Casey Anthony case, and it was that way for the duration.
That's right, yep.
So there's not really an apples-to-apples comparison in that, to my knowledge, her defense is not being paid for by the media. Or, you know, some of the definitions or changes to the current case if they're being changed by, you know, any reporting, it's just happening now. It wasn't happening prior to the case. Going to court.
I had a choice between a rerun of Gilligan's Island and the 48 hours coverage of Jodi Arias here the other night. So I, between the skipper and Gilligan, I'd flip back and forth to watch them. And
did you see the one before this update that that debuted this weekend? Okay,
yes.
So then you could you noticed the contrast in what was deleted from the footage.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. What about that 48 hours? Interview, if you want to call it that, is this going to help or hurt her?
Well, unfortunately, I think it does a little bit of both, but it certainly, if it was seen, and it has been subpoenaed as evidence in this case, I expect the defense is going to show this at length, the first 48 hours. And within that, the problem for the prosecution is that Detective Esteban Flores repeatedly discusses his theory that Travis Alexander was shot first, which negates some of the aggravating factors that are contributory to the first, the premeditation charge and or the application to the death penalty. That's a problem.
Yep.
And that problem was not, when I call it a problem, I mean, that is new to this prosecution and the defense, because Detective Flores was on the stand and literally said, you know, this is the first I've heard of it. After the medical examiner, Dr. Horn, testified, which in itself, I would need to look this up, Dana, but I'm not understanding how a detective who's a witness in a case was allowed to watch the testimony of another witness, because in every other, you know, district court, Superior Court level trial, I'm aware, criminal trial I'm aware of, those folks are invoked.
Yeah, I saw that too, and why there wasn't an exclusion of him as a witness, I have no idea. It's this, it's a head-scratcher, and there's more head-scratchers when it comes to this. Let's talk about that pathologist and what he's saying.
Well, Dr. Horn, while I think he's a fine pathologist, I think sometimes what happens is, you know, he's no, I said in my piece, my piece before the recent update, that he was no Dr. G, because he's not. You'll never hear, being familiar with her personally, disclosing that, but you'll never hear her say something that she could not substantiate in her findings, ever. And unfortunately, I feel like Dr. Horn stretched his expertise in this case. When you have a decedent that's unfortunately been deceased for 5 days, and you have a bullet wound where you can no longer track the path in his right frontal lobe, you can't say he was incapacitated and nearly killed from it. You can't tell me that when he's got a, you know, an ear-to-ear gaping gash, and neither of those things killed him. Interestingly enough, he died from a stab wound to the heart, which actually pierced the sac, the pericardial sac, I believe, but the vena cava in particular. So to say he was near death or that could have killed him, when in fact it didn't kill him, that was not his finding, it does not help to substantiate the charges that are before the court, which is the problem here.
We'll bounce, we'll bounce around a little bit on this. Blink from Blink on Crime is here, and I'll go right to that. When we ask the question and comment about the premeditation, what do you think?
What I think, and what I think the prosecution can prove in this case, as they've just, as they've rested, so there's not a whole lot in the way of, you know, latitude that they're going to have. What I personally believe, as my opinion as an analyst, is that she absolutely planned this crime. I believe that whatever transpired between the two while they were together may have had her rethink her initiative, and then something happened to set her off in a way that was final. And I think Dr. Bond did it. One of the things that I struggle with as an analyst myself is trying to articulate to folks the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath, and it is very important in criminal analysis. You are not going to see a psychopath until they offend. They're just that good at it. They're so detached, they're so energetic, they're so focused on not on emulating people that are supposed to be normal, that it's just impossible. They're not going to let you close enough that you're going to see the cracks in the cement like a sociopath. And for him to categorize Casey and Jody Arias as both being that, their profiles are textbooked for it. But my point in saying that is it means that there was a little bit of latitude in what was going to transpire that day, in my opinion. And as I wrote, I definitely believe that it was clear to Jody at a point when Travis was in the shower that she was incensed beyond her ability to curtail it, and also whatever it was so offensive to her, everything that she had been sitting on, if you will, in that, 28-hour or 30-hour drive where she likely was only thinking about this outcome, transpired. I think she premeditated. I'm not convinced at all that the state has proven this case. Just because she rented a car, just because she, allegedly there's a gun missing from the grandparents' home that they cannot tie to this woman.
Right.
They can tie it to the crime scene, potentially through a casing, but they don't have the gun to match the ballistics to say it actually came from the gun that was from the grandparents' home.
No, in typical fashion, defense lawyers are jumping up and asking for all sorts of motions to, throw things out. And I agree with you when it comes to the prosecution case. It's a bit of a head scratcher, and maybe they'll be able to fill some of those holes. Maybe they won't. I'm not sure. But what do you think the defense will be able to do, or what do you think they'll have to do now?
Well, it's that old adage, and I can remember having, it's surreal in a way, Dana, because I can remember you and I having this conversation in the Anthony trial where you said to me, do you think she'll take the stand?
Yeah.
I said, absolutely, under no set of circumstances will she take the stand, and there's just no way. And she didn't, because her lawyer, Jose Baez, he already laid the predicate for her defense. There was no need at that point for her to go on. As a matter of fact, it would have whittled away what he had tried to accomplish, I believe. She wouldn't have been able to substantiate his argument or his close. In this case, I don't see her getting out of at least the jury wanting to find a felony murder case, which there's been no crime. I mean, to back up a little bit, the state has never alleged that there was a crime committed prior to the commission of Travis Alexander's murder. And I believe, again, this is what I'll call upcharging, I believe they did that because they want to force the jury to have a finding that results in the only other, verdict, which is for premeditation, capital first-degree murder. In other words, they're putting two things in front of the jury. They're swinging for the fence. They're hoping that the jury is going to be so unjust should she not be convicted of the felony murder that they're going to have a finding. When I heard the questions from the jury, I just think they have overshot this one. And when I see what's coming in terms of, let's talk about what's really in effect here.
Yep.
There are outstanding motions for directed verdict and a mistrial.
Right, yep.
That's where we are with a week, hiatus
29th,
for the defense to start.
Yeah.
Who's to say Judge Stevens is not going to rule? And I have to say, the directed verdict is rare, and I don't see her making that leap at this juncture, although she can technically split that verdict. In other words, she can order the jury to find not guilty on the premeditation if she feels strongly that it was not proven. I don't think she's going to do that. I'm not as confident about the mistrial because I do think there has been a level of prosecutorial misconduct. it's not the first time it has happened to Juan Martinez. It's not the first time it has happened to the Maricopa County District Attorney's Office. I mentioned in one of my pieces a guy by the name of Doug Grant. It's called the Mormon Murder. Very wealthy vitamin guy. Ended up going into business with another gentleman who ended up swindling $52 million from people and killing himself in prison a couple of years later. But what happened was, in the middle of his trial, when the prosecutor was removed and Juan Martinez stepped in, what they did was they added what's called the lesser included, because they knew they were not going to get a conviction as a capital case, as premeditated murder. And what ended up happening with him is he was convicted of manslaughter. And when you have a crime scene like this one, where you have a 123-pound, 5'3" woman,
right,
and you have Travis Alexander, 5'9", 190 pounds, deceased with blood loss, and the prosecution is saying, this happened here, this happened here, look at this blood, look at this, she drug him from this location to that location, that's going to be very difficult for a jury to buy. And when you have a jury that is starting to try to put the pieces together, again, I'll compare it to the Casey Anthony case and that jury's deliberations. With Kaylee, they left, maybe it was chloroform. Maybe she died by asphyxiation with tape on her mouth. They thought that leaving it to the jury to make those decisions still pointed to the defendant. It didn't.
No.
The jury, in what I've been saying this now for almost 2 years, when you adopt the CSI effect, when you're watching Criminal Minds and you're watching these shows that get wrapped up in an hour, and it absolutely puts, dots the I's, crosses the T's, it's got the finest point on these cases, that develops a thought process in folks that follow true crime.
Blink from Blink on Crime is here. I want to get into the history of Jody and the victim a little bit. But what are your thoughts on the, and I know she's been telling all sorts of stories, but the self-defense aspect of this, is that going to fly at all, or do you think they'll even use it?
I think they have to use it. I can't say that they won't do it in what is called a, kind of an obtuse way.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, when presenting to the jury, they've obviously made a strategic decision whether or not Jody is going to testify. That's already done.
Yep.
So are they going to try to impart into the jury through their defense witnesses that it was impossible that it happened any other way? It's possible, because I believe they laid the predicate for that in their cross-examination, where they were talking about water in the closet and water in how it affected a storage box that was in his bedroom closet. And I think where they're going with that is they're going to say, Travis was in the shower, he lunged at her, he chased her into that closet. That's how the water got there. No, she wasn't trying to clean it up. And she fought for her life. The gun went off. He wasn't dead. He grabbed a knife. She, all the things, he cut, she tried to grab it from him. She did. That's how she cut her hand. There's 100 ways to make this play in terms of a defense. And make no mistake, that's what prosecutors and defense attorneys do. They sit there and they decide what the case is going to look like, arguably mock jury form, to each other.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying?
Sure. Yep.
Right. They're going, okay, this is what the prosecution's like. This is what the evidence can lead to. And here are all our, examples under B. But do I think it's a defendable case? Yes. But mostly why I think that? Because I don't feel like the prosecution did its homework. I do not believe that they have given the defense all of their interviews and witnesses. I just put out a piece today where there are three witnesses right now, one of which has never been given to the defense but was interviewed three times, a guy by the name of Thomas Brown, who's literally finding out that in a police interview, Jody Arias named him as a possible on January 9th. How does that happen in a criminal, in a capital case? How does someone that was interviewed three times by the lead detective in a case, obviously, if he's interviewed three times but was never approached by the defense, what does that tell you?
Yeah.
He was a roommate. He was in the home when she arrived. He was there. how does it happen that that information is not turned over to the defense? And it's mistakes like that that either cause a mistrial, cause a directed verdict, or guess what? Get overturned on appeal. And the problem, and why I'm a little bit soapboxy about that, is because, number one, I think this girl is nuts, and I think she obliterated this guy.
Sure, yeah.
And she deserves to spend the rest of her life in prison. So why am I bringing up and why am I writing about, you know, the other side of the coin? Because I want to make sure she goes there, and I want to make sure she stays there, and I want to make sure that as prosecutors that we are doing the diligence so that there's not another Casey Anthony verdict because of hubris.
Yeah.
That's what happened. They were high-fiving each other down at the courthouse thinking they had a set case. They didn't really listen to anybody that was saying, geez, I think here's where the holes are. They didn't. As a result, in my opinion, that's why she was acquitted. Because they didn't have it. Had she been convicted, based on the problems that they had with the evidence that we know now, it would have been a reversible error anyway, and she would have walked.
Yeah.
That's really not okay with me.
Blink from Blink on Crime is here. You mentioned a second ago spending the rest of her days in jail. Or is this a death penalty case?
I don't think a jury is going to put her to death, and I'll tell you why. I don't think they are able. I don't think they're going to buy the fact that the premeditation and the cruelty factors are there just based on the size of the two of them and her inability to contain him in an attack situation the way the prosecution is developing it. And they may not care. But to articulate that a little bit better, I don't believe they, if the questions that they asked at the end of the state's case lead me to believe they do not buy she did this on her own already. Could that change once the defense presents? Possibly, but honestly, we don't know that the defense isn't going to show up on the 29th and say, you know what? We feel that the state has not presented, it has not proven its case. We rest. I don't think that would be a good idea, but
yeah.
It certainly wouldn't be unheard of.
It's possible. I don't think it's going to happen either. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. Check out our webpage at blinkoncrime.com. Let's get back to the 48 hours interview a little bit. When we watched it, both parts, and you see Jodi Arias's reaction, and you know, again, the investigator in me is listening to her talk, and I'm asking her questions at the same time, knowing very well she can't answer me, but it kind of drove me nutso, because her story is about as phony as a $3 bill in most cases. Yet the defense is going to use that interview. Will the prosecution be able to impeach that and say you were telling CBS a whole bunch of crapola?
Well, I think yes, of course they can, but I think they did that in their opening where they already said she's a liar and they already said she killed him. It was, you know, kill or be killed scenario. I think they had no choice but to, they knew this was coming. I think they had no choice to say that. And I also think if you're analyzing that, the way to present your case as a prosecutor, it could have been much more thorough. I would have taken her individual statements and presented my case chronologically to impeach them one by one. And I know why the prosecutor did not show the video, and I'll tell you, it's because, as I said before, you have Detective Flores throughout the whole thing saying, you know, yes, she was shot in the head first, and no, as a matter of fact, she had nothing to do with Travis's, you know, slash tires. There was never any evidence of that. He knew bringing it in would allow the defense to rebut that evidence or impeach that evidence. And that was already a serious problem when Detective Flores was on the stand. But I think, again, it's one of those philosophies of, do we put it out there first so we don't look like we're hiding something, which I think would have worked. She's just not a likable person.
No.
And clearly, she's a sociopath. I think a layperson can look at her, and I don't think they're saying, oh, that poor shrinking Violet I don't think she told the truth once. She doesn't have, you know, she has one member of her family in the jury, or excuse me, in the public in the seating. She has no friends speaking out on her behalf. There was a woman that testified, yes. But basically the prosecution put her on to say, you know, to basically say this is how nuts she is, because she could go commit a crime like this and then go hang out with her girlfriend, and the girlfriend never knew anything was wrong.
Oh, so true. Now, you and I will be talking in 2 weeks. Where do you think we'll be at that time with this case?
I think it's possible there will be a mistrial.
Okay.
I do. Yeah. I wish the heck I didn't feel like that. But honestly, I favor that over a directed verdict. But if we're talking in 2 weeks and there isn't a mistrial, I think we're going to see the witnesses that I just talked about. We're going to see how, in an obtuse way, without saying, hey, that, you know, that second story about there being an intruder, there might be just a little bit of truth to that. I believe that's where they're going. I think they're going to say, oh, you told us that she was the stalker and she was slashing tires. Well, let me tell you who that really was, and let me tell you who was really after Travis Alexander. I think that's where they're going to go. They're just trying to create a reasonable doubt. They need one person, Dana, out of 12. They need one person that will not unanimously agree with the others. And when I read those jury questions, and I agree, you know, granted it's in the beginning of the case, it was at, you know, right before the state rested, and the defense has not put on their case, I have concerns. The way this case is charged versus the prosecution's case and what I feel that they were able to bring to bear do not match for me. So we're either going to be learning about the potential for a mistrial, which I think there's some merit to it. It just keeps adding up. The witnesses I'm talking about were withheld again from the defense.
It's, you know, I'm not making light. There's a person that was savagely murdered here, but do you think Lifetime is sending a script to Rob Lowe right now as we speak?
He gets the work, doesn't he? When I watch Dr. Horno, it's like he even sounds like him.
Oh,
how do I not write that? Because it was freakish. And I don't think in any stretch of the imagination he looks like Jeff Ashton.
No.
But I've met him. First of all, Jeff Ashton is incredibly tall.
Yeah.
And slender. He's just not at all, you know.
Yeah.
It just wasn't a good fit, but I understood the reason. In this case, he looks just like Dr. Horn.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But anyway, we'll be in touch, Blink, from blinkoncrime.com. Follow that site for all your Jody Arias and other crime-related investigations and stories, because if that's a story out there that needs to be told, Blink will tell it. Thank you, ma'am.
Oh, thank you. Be well, Dana.
We'll talk soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Blink from Blink on Crime. And, yeah, she's our sister blogger. She talks about the stories that sometimes don't get told. It'll be interesting to see what happens. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of ScaredMonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.